Keep it coming, keep it coming, keep it coming, full steam. 4:52. Let's start the show.
Go. Am I?
Logan, like Logan for the win. Logan, make us an intro, anything you want. That's what he makes us. You know, and this is the thing. I don't think Logan does drugs.
No,
he's a, you're a Mormon, right, Logan? Oh. Lapsed Mormon?
Guns are my drugs.
Because your guns are my drugs.
That's a good shirt. We should make that a shirt.
Guns are my drugs?
Guns are my drugs.
It beats butthurt. Actually, nothing beats this shirt. Nothing beats this shirt. You can order this. Sonia Chiappetti will tell you how to order it. One of the Z-Packers in the comments. Created by military personnel for everyone to understand the meaning of butthurt. Anyways, guys.
So today we're talking about how home healthcare workers are poor AF.
Poor AF. There was an article in Stat News. Was it Stat News or somewhere else? I forget.
I can't remember.
It doesn't matter where it was. But it was basically about how home care workers, people who go to people's houses, take care of them, turn them, vulnerable elderly people, people with disabilities, people who are recovering at home, frontline healthcare workers, members of the Z-Pack, make something like $9.90 an hour and do not get the very healthcare benefits that their patients have. Including with Obamacare, they fall through the cracks a lot of the time. And this is a huge problem because many of them are sick, have chronic disease, but we're relying on this population of really selfless people to care for people at home. And this is a growing, booming population as boomers age and start to retire. Home care. So I wanted to get the Z-Pack's input on this because I know many members of the Z-Pack's are CNAs or home care workers. I've spoken many times for home care organizations, Carpenters Foundation in Louisiana, Foundations Residential Home Health in Michigan. And these are great organizations. They want to do the best thing for patients. But are we treating our home care workers with the respect and the level of income that they need to actually do their job?
Hey, Z, when you say $10 an hour, do you mean $10 an hour without tax or with tax? Is this under the table?
No, this isn't under the table. This is over the table. So they're getting taxed on that 10 bucks. And so it's a really, so the average home care worker makes less than $20,000 a year, according to the article that I read, and which I need to post when I find it again. I saw it this morning from, it was CNN, I think.
I always thought that home health care was like expensive.
Home health care? Well, it depends. So actually it's underfunded generally, it's under reimbursed by insurance, Medicare has very strict rules around it, and yet, if you're actually sick and you're trying to get better, would you rather be in a hospital, a nursing home, a long-term care facility, or home with somebody actually taking care of you? And the thing is, these environments are not exactly the friendliest and safest environments. A lot of times people's homes are a very dangerous place for healthcare workers to go, whether there's family members doing, you know, having criminal activity, drugs, dangerous items, getting through the house of an elderly person who may have dementia, other functional limitations. It is hard, dangerous work, and these guys are very low paid, right? And so you have to really love the work and you have to be good at it, but also who is taking care of the people who are taking care of these people? I think that's the question.
That's interesting. I mean, if I need home health care, it's like, it's cheap for me? I don't get it, because how can it be only $10 that we're paying them an hour?
Well, no, that's just for the home care person. And there's different levels of that too, so you could send a nurse there, they're not getting 10 bucks an hour. But somebody who's doing low-level home care, and I want the Z-Pack to weigh in on this. See, here, Leah and Chris Stipe, I'm a home health nurse and I make great money, but sadly the CNAs don't make much, which I think they should make more. So the certified nursing assistants, they don't make that much. And of course, the home care agencies are gonna have to allocate their human resources because that's their biggest expense. So they're gonna rely on lower wage workers whenever possible. But the question is, what can we do about this if there's a limited amount of money reimbursed? And I know the home care agencies are struggling with reimbursements. And I spoke actually for a home care consortium in the Northeast. And this is a big struggle. How do they get reimbursed for the value that they provide?
What about hospice? Do you think when my grandfather died, we gave a couple $1,000s to the hospice organization that had helped him because they had done such a good job.
Right, and hospice is cash strapped as well, and the same sort of workers that may work with home health may work with hospice. And actually, one of the big challenges we had when we were discharging patients from the hospital is if they go to hospice, that doesn't necessarily mean they have home care with them. It means they're home, the hospice agency's consulting, but the family needs to hire home care or use other resources to get the actual 24/7 care And a lot of times families need to step up if they're not in an inpatient hospice. And this was in California when I was working there.
So I mean, yeah, yeah. Right? If I was gonna die, I would wanna die in my own home.
Right? Most people say they want to, and most people don't die in their own home. Most people die in the hospital. And the question is why this disconnect between what we want and what actually happens. I would argue, number one, it's a medical industrial complex. We really like to do things to people. Our system isn't really set up to have these end of life conversations in advance so that we know what people want. And then the payment thing. A lot of times insurance will cover dying in the hospital, but it's trickier to get the coverage for dying in the home with appropriate care. And a lot of times families feel overwhelmed. When it comes to it, they'd rather have their loved one in a hospital where they think they're getting a higher level of care, but it may not be where the loved one wants to die. It may not be the best place to die if you do it right, right?
Okay, so like magic wand, you're in charge now. How do you fix that?
Blow the whole thing up with a nuclear bomb stolen from Kim Jong-un, who's apparently building them and aiming them at the West Coast. So I would just blow it all up, melt it into glass, and start from scratch. But that's me if I have a magic wand and I don't have to blow it all up. What I would say is when we actually pay healthcare practitioners and entities based on actual outcomes that matter to patients. So a good death, how do you quantify that? You know, a patient wanting to die at home, saving all the ICU money and all the hospital money. If we actually reimburse based on the value that we generate, then home care would actually get the money that they need to pay their workers, even their lowest level workers, better. And we would actually have outcomes that matter to patients. So that's the magic wand, is we need to transform how we pay for healthcare, and then the model of care needs to be team-based, 3.0 in the sense that we're talking to each other, we're collaborating across the continuum. So the home care agency is really deeply tied to the family medicine doc, who's deeply tied to the emergency department. So if the patient gets admitted, they coordinate very quickly and they find the best triage for that patient. Right now, none of that really happens well.
And I'm imagining disability factors into this a lot with home healthcare. Is that accurate?
In the sense that the patient is disabled or disability?
So Social Security disability.
Well, it can, and actually I'd have to lean on my social work colleagues and my case manager colleagues who would do this work for me. They would dig into, okay, what are the resources that this patient can pull on to get the care they need at home? And sometimes they are public resources like that, and sometimes there are other resources. Sometimes it's Medicaid. Sometimes you have to spend all your money down until you get into Medicaid level poverty so that you can get these social resources.
My grant, we actually had to do that with my grandma.
Oh, is that what happened?
To get the hospice care and all that, and physical therapy for her after she had a stroke.
So your grandma had an embolism to the brain.
Yes.
And then you had to spend her money down.
Down to get Medicaid.
Yeah.
To pay for stuff.
And then you qualified for Medicaid, and then Medicaid covered certain services.
Beth wow. Martell Bailey says, both my parents wanted to die at home. I honored that and made sure they were at home when they both passed. 19 years tomorrow, my dad passed away. I had a similar situation with my grandfather, who was dying of leukemia in the hospital, and they were going to give him last rites in the hospital. He did everything to stay alive until he got home, and then he died 2 weeks later.
Man, I tell you, the will that people have when they want something, right? And we ought to be honoring and respecting that, but all too often, the opposite occurs. It becomes a mess, et cetera. You know, one thing I want to say about this, I mean, this kind of leads into the next piece of news we were talking about, which is the elderly gentleman who was shot on Facebook by a clear sociopath, right?
Oh God, if you haven't seen this video, don't watch it. Me and Logan watched it just now. Z didn't want to watch it because he's sane and normal and well-adjusted.
Well, my problem, we'll fill in some backstory. So the story with this is there's a guy called the Easter Facebook Killer or something now, and on Easter Day, he took his camera and he drove up to an elderly gentleman, 74-year-old African-American guy, and basically said, hey, do you know such and such, which was his girlfriend's name? And the guy said, I don't know anybody by that name. And he shoots the guy in the head, and then tells into the phone, this is his ex-girlfriend, right? You see, what would he say, Tom?
He said, she's the reason this is about to happen to you. And then he shoots the dude, and then he says, you see, this guy's obviously psychotic, but we were kind of talking about, is it, you know, obviously it's super tragic what happened, but considering how many people die in America in such worse circumstances, is a quick death clean? I mean, it's not a clean death, but is a quick death sometimes better?
Well, so it's funny because the first elephant response I had to that news was, well, 74-year-old guy was murdered in cold blood by a clearly, I wouldn't say psychotic, I would say psychopathic. So somebody with no empathy who's clearly behaving, he's rational. In other words, the way he's talking on the phone and stuff, it's clearly rational. He's not having delusions. He's just a complete a-hole with no compassion whatsoever. And my first elephant thought was, oh, well, okay, 74 years old, you know, maybe the guy had dementia, maybe this was, it's weird how the elephant behaves. Immediately I was thinking, well, maybe this was, because I've seen so many patients suffer in the hospital at end of life. Then immediately I was like, no, it doesn't even matter if that was the case. This is a cold-blooded murder. But it's, the more you sort of practice sort of being aware of what your elephant thinks, the more you can recognize it and not judge it and go, God, my elephant's an asshole. Instead, you look at it and go, wow, that's how my unconscious mind processed that. It sees a, sort of this matrix, this moral matrix, and it says, boop, this, based on everything that I've been exposed to. And what, I mean, what was your elephant saying?
Ah, man, my elephant kind of had a similar reaction where I thought, well, and then, but then I thought, oh, I guess it'd be good to go clean and quick instead of, but I think you want to die on your own terms. Well, that was my second elephant reaction.
Right, so the elephant starts, you know, by the way, let me clarify this.
My elephant was confused.
Neither Tom and I are advocating the killing of elderly gentlemen on Facebook Live. What we're saying is,
no.
How do you respond immediately to the news of a senseless death when you start getting the information? Especially if you watch the video. Now, I didn't watch the video because I have something called empathy that Tom may lack. So he can, that's not true actually, Tom has empathy.
Distressing me a little that I watched the video because I watched it with the sound off earlier and it was just a person getting shot. And then I watched it with the sound on and I heard this guy talk and I felt really terrible after watching it.
It's really horrifying.
And I don't recommend watching it to the audience.
Don't watch the video, but what we're saying is, Tom and Logan watched it right before the show. And I could just see like, oh, a switch had snapped and they were like grim. Like this had affected them because again, human being. So the point is when you, when your unconscious elephant starts making these snap judgments, our little writer can override and can say, no, this is terrible. But it's interesting to see what the elephant reacts to. I'll tell you why my elephant reacted that way because I have seen elderly people suffer and die in the hospital, a torturous, prolonged death. And so when you see someone senselessly murdered who's in that age bracket, my elephant thought, okay, first of all, death, mortality, what's the meaning of it? What is a good death? What's a bad death, right? And the idea of dying quickly and painlessly is very appealing to me because I've seen it go the other way. Now, the thing is, there's no redemption in this death because it was senseless. The guy was a healthy, happy.
He looked like he was walking to get his groceries. Yeah. Like he still had a lot of, like right, probably right, 10, right. 20 years maybe left.
Right,
so
right.
Who knows?
And even without that, it doesn't matter, right? But the thing is, again, we're talking about our unconscious processor. Until you kind of see how that behaves and how it feels disgust and revulsion and love and hope, it's very hard to really understand the mind. That got us talking earlier before the show started about these Buddhist monks who can light themselves on fire as a protest against, say, Chinese involvement in Nepal. It doesn't matter, in
right.
Tibet.
There's that famous picture from, you know, a lot of people saw it on, was it Rage Against the Machine's cover?
Yeah.
Of the guy self-immolating, the
It's
Tibetan
a great
Buddhist.
Cover, by the way. Killing in the name of, dun-dun, dun, now you do what they told you, dun-dun, dun, now you do, butthurt. But this idea that if you understand the mind and how it works, you can endure and in a detached way, tremendous suffering, like lighting yourself on fire until you die. You can also feel tremendous and unequivocal and unconditional love towards everybody and everything. And that's another function of practice. Did I tell you the story when I was in the Grand Canyon, I was on a shuttle bus. I don't think I told Tom this story.
No, tell me.
I was on, okay. These shuttle buses in the Grand Canyon, they go by every 15 minutes. So if you miss one, you're standing there like a ding-dong with your family for another 15 minutes, okay? So people pile on these things, and it's like a Japanese subway. Like, people are like this, right? And so we're waiting for one. It's a peak season. It's Easter. The Z-pups are cranky because they know we're gonna make them hike up and down this canyon, which, by the way, in the end, they loved because they got chicken wings and pizza afterwards. We get on this thing. Everybody's sitting down, we're all standing. So my little girls, you know, ages 6 and 9, 5 and a half and 9, are sitting there on this thing, holding the thing. Two Buddhist monks are sitting in the seats.
Robes and everything?
Robes and everything. Shaved head, like.
So they were Hare Krishnas.
No. They were Tibetan monks. Like I could tell because it's a phenotype, right? And the cool, you know why I knew they were monks? Because they had cool as hell Maui Jim shades on.
Oh, they were wearing Oakleys.
Sweet Oakleys. So they have the robes and all that, but they're wearing the dope, you know, polarized lenses. And so the dude's just without even missing a beat, stands up, looks at my oldest daughter, and says, sit. And she sits, and she's sitting there, and he's just standing over her, looking at her with this beaming love, right?
Yeah.
Which hopefully wasn't creepy.
you would assume if he's a monk, I guess.
I just assume. I mean, if he was a Catholic priest, it would have been a different assumption. But
yes.
He was a monk, so I was like, I was cool with it.
Well, she was a girl, so.
And so, the day after Easter, Tom, really, the day after Jesus was resuscitated.
By the way, what kind of hack are you that you didn't bring Z Bunny up here to the studio for the people?
Okay, listen to this, guys. So
give the people what they want, Z.
Tom's been hassling me because me and Mrs. Dog did an AMA yesterday without them. First of all, proving them redundant and useless. Second of all, proving Mrs. Dog actually exists, which was important, and she's smart. But third of all, he was like, why don't you bring Z Bunny up because it's Easter and like the Z Pack really wants to see a bunny. And I'm like, okay, let me tell you what happens when you lift a bunny like mine. Okay, this bunny is tame AF until you pick it up. It looks like the Tasmanian devil. There's a cloud of blood and skin flakes and eyeballs because it will... He wanted me to do this. He wanted me to take a hit for the team. I'm not doing it. Okay, I love you, Z Pack, but I don't love you enough to lose an eye or injure my taint.
All right, back to the monk story.
So the monk, anyways, it stands up and it's just beaming at my daughter. And the other monk stands up and the other daughter sits. And this was the funny thing. They were the beneficiaries of this amazing compassion, but this is what it ended up looking like. Daddy was standing here. These two monks were basically flanking my daughters with smelly pits, like they were standing like this. So smelly monk pits, like no deodorant for the monks, right? Oakley's, but no deodorant. They're both sitting in the seat like, I'm the beneficiary of tremendous compassion and wisdom, and I have to smell this stank. And they look like this the whole time. They're just looking at Daddy like, you mother, you let me sit in. And so we get off, and they're like, if you, my oldest Z-pup was like, if you ever do that again, Daddy, this vacation's over. I'm just gonna walk home. Because those people were stinky. And I'm like, they were loving, compassionate monks who were beaming with joy having given you the gift of seating. And they're like, they gave me the gift of stank. Because both of their pits stank worse than yours, Daddy, and your pits stink. By the way, my daughter, my oldest Z-pup, came home today, and she's like, I drew a picture of you, Daddy, look. Now, for the podcast people, I'm ripped in this picture. I have abs, I have pecs, I have biceratopses, okay? Totally ripped. I'm also a woman. I have beautiful, voluptuous lips.
Eyeshadow,
long hair. And above it, I'm wearing a beanie that says Daddy. Okay?
That's a beret.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't realize I was so cultured. By the way, didn't you say something about French people when you were in Zion this weekend?
Oh, I learned an interesting fact about French people that when you arrive in the airport in France, you're assigned a pet cat and a boyfriend just upon landing. And that happens for everybody.
We have no evidence for this, but apparently to Tom, that just feels right. No, Tom was complaining that the French people that were visiting the park had no sense of personal space.
Oh my God, they were the rudest people ever. And listen, I was like, we saved you, man. Like, I get to go first down this path, okay? You remember World War II?
I do. I remember Dunkirk, snitches. Here's the thing. So my dad says the same thing. He's like, the French are the most ungrateful of anybody. Because I'll tell you, we saved them 2 world wars. We saved them. I'm like, who's this we? You were in India. No, with the British and the English. We were part of British Empire. Anyways, now what do? They pay us back by making the restaurants with that frog's leg. It's tiny. Looks like a cockroach on a tiny piece of lettuce. And they're like, this is your dinner, $50. I'm like, I don't want this crap. Take me to McDonald's. Get me McNuggets. Okay, McNuggets. None of this French fries. Give me freedom fries only. Yeah, my dad's a militant anti-Francophile. I love French people. Kate, I took French in high school.
Kate says Tom needs to avoid China if he needs personal space.
Oh,
I really need personal space.
Dude.
In Tokyo, Shanghai, Hong Kong. That freaks me out, man. I've seen the pictures.
You know what? Take an Air India flight anywhere.
Really?
Yeah. My dad is... here's the thing. My dad, being Indian, is the most racist against Indian people that you would ever imagine. Like, he's like, every time you get on, these Faltu people are in your face, their pit is in your face, nobody's taking shower, everybody's pushing and pushing and pushing. It's true, though, because personal space in very crowded countries is a different game, man.
Oh, yeah, dude.
I'm telling you.
I've seen the Darjeeling Limited.
Tom understands the world through movies.
I do.
E.T. the extra testicle was how he learned that having 3 testicles was a bad idea and had one removed. Let's read some comments. Beth Buck, I'm sorry, but every time you emulate your dad, I laugh. He sounds like a great and fun guy, Beth Buck. He is a great and fun guy if you're not his son. If you're his son, then it's complicated because it's dad. But everybody else is like, you're, why am I suddenly doing the accent? your dad is very good only. He's very good.
Next time it's a holiday, Z-Dad's going to be on Incident Report. Guarantee it, peeps.
No diggity. No diggity.
I'm going to make it happen.
He's going to make it happen. No, honestly, I'm going to be up in the Fresno area visiting Z-Dad in the summer. So you can bet that Incident Report Live will have Z-Dad and Z-Mom and maybe even Z-Sister if Z-Sister is around because she lives in the area. Alexander Wu, I like Mrs. Dog more than Logan and Tom. She's got an awesome, suck it, you guys. She's got an awesome personality, intelligence, and actually contributed to a great discussion. She has way more class than both of them.
That's what you come here for? To listen to a discussion between learned doctors? Whoa, Logan. Whoa, put it away, man. Put it away. Thank you. Put it away.
This is a house of learned doctors, man. You aren't a doctor! I wouldn't have this any other way.
Angie Shaw says, I actually work home health here in Indiana. I actually really love doing it. I get to actually do nursing care like you can't in any facility.
Yeah, I mean, people who work home care, they're passionate about this, right? Z-Packers, tell me if I'm wrong about this. They love what they do. They feel like they're making a huge impact because they are. But they are, a lot of them are underpaid now. The nurses less so, but again, the sort of CNAs, the lower level home aides, it's a struggle, you know? And it's not... Again, it's not the safest work. It's not the cleanest work. It's very hard work, right?
Tamara says the difference with home health is we have to do more. We do our own wound vacs, et cetera.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. So they do everything.
Do more with less, right?
Do more with less. That's health 2.0, actually. Mm-hmm. That's 2.0 in a nutshell. It's like how much can we squeeze out of each provider? Because everybody's genericized as a provider. I like the term practitioner because we all practice the dark arts of healthcare in some way, shape, or form, right? If you touch patients, you're a practitioner of some kind. Whoa. Is she Dr. Mrs. Dog? If so, show some respect. Paige Massey. Paige, I listed her as Mrs. Dog MD. So give the appropriate props.
The first time I ever met her, I said, oh, it's so nice to meet you, Mrs. Dog. And she said, my name is Dr. Demonia.
And she was effing with Tom, but she enjoyed that a lot.
Tamara says, so hard to get docs on the phone and hands are tied a lot of the time in home health.
Oh, yeah, no, it's true. Because again, the cohesion across the continuum of care isn't really there and it's not really incentivized in health 2.0 or health 1.0. In 3.0, again, it's gotta be, everyone's skin has to be in the game, taking care of the patient with producing good outcomes. So that means that not being available to the home health team if you're the primary doc is a bad outcome for the patient.
Can we double back on like, you know, sort of judging elderly people in the hospital and, you know, how many qualitative years they have left. I think that's a really interesting conversation to have because, like, I feel like both of our elephant reactions were a little Kevorkian-esque.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's because we're assholes, but also because our elephants, we can't control what our elephants do. We can only recognize it and choose to act or not act on it or understand, make judgments after the fact. But the elephant makes an instant processor, right?
Well, there is a moral, you know, I mean, if somebody has a lot of years left on this planet, potentially, stealing that from them is more wrong than, you know.
So if you're making a judgment using this unconscious processor, and the judgment is, well, the life of a 74-year-old is worth less than the life of a 24-year-old or a 14-year-old or a 4-year-old.
Do you know about Todd Heap? Todd Heap was a tight end for the Ravens, and for 10 years he was a pro bowler, and he recently backed over his 3-year-old in Phoenix, and the child died at the hospital. And that is, I think we all, when we hear that, that is like just an unspeakable tragedy, you know? And that's because of how young the child is.
So see, immediately my elephant like wants to force me into breaking into tears because I imagine my own child and all the years that they've lost and the horror of feeling culpable for the death of your child even though it was an accident. And think how you feel if your child drowns. Or I mean, these things happen to good people all the time. And it's not necessarily negligence. It's just hard raising kids and being safe. The world is a dangerous place. So how does the elephant respond? Immediately, I'm just horribly saddened, right? Whereas the elephant responding to an elderly person's death for me, again, it does all that math. Like, well, was it a good death? Was it comfortable? did it spare them this or that, right? Now, I'm not saying this is right. I'm not even condoning it. I'm just saying this is how the unconscious mind behaves. If we can't even, if we get so butthurt even talking about it, like how our mind works, then we're never going
to
understand it.
It's important to talk about because everybody has these sort of feelings. I mean, we can't be the only people in the world having the same feeling at the same time.
No, no, no. And then the difference between us and a psychopath is a psychopath has those feelings and their little writer acts on them and thinks everything is fine and never second guesses any of it.
Right. Yeah, like this guy, like this guy, the Easter Facebook killer.
Yep.
You know what? All the time I have thoughts where I'm like, I was hiking up these canyon walls in Zion just a couple days ago, and I was like, I could just push this person off that canyon. Jesus. I didn't do it, but I thought about it.
Oh my gosh, you are the opposite of a Buddhist monk. Actually, no, you might be the same, at least pit-wise. No, but this is true. We all have these impulsive thoughts. How many times have you stood on the edge? Like when I was in the Grand Canyon, there's a picture of me on Instagram, literally on the edge of this precipice, 1,000-foot drop, whatever it is, putting a Health 3.0 mug up there or something. And I'm impulsive. I was like, I could just jump right now, see what it's like to die. It'd be fun. It'd be really cool. How many times have you had those thoughts? The difference is we have a frontal lobe that'll second guess that and put the brakes on it. It's just like we have a frontal lobe that's gonna go, no, this is actually a terrible, both deaths are horrible tragedies, right?
Yeah, we were climbing Angel's Landing, which is a really hard trail.
Terrifying.
And it's on my shirt.
Yeah, and, because he is that guy.
You have to hang on to these little chains and make your way up this, like, there's steep drop this way. And my wife is like, you're scared of heights, huh? I was like, I have a healthy respect to heights, woman. My mind is always going, you could fall, don't fall, you could fall.
I mean, think about what the unconscious mind does. It's a threat detector, right? It's there to, the elephant is there to keep us safe, to form tribal relationships, to have in-group, out-group conflict. So like we protect our tribe at the expense of others. That's why empathy, I've argued, is a bad thing, because it tends to be narrow and it tends to focus on our own tribe and our people that are like us that resonate with our elephant. And that causes us to do things that are not in the most compassionate interest of the largest number of people. So
yeah, as Zia said before, if you're empathetic, you're also a racist.
I'm not sure I've ever, I like that though. It has no basis in reality or logic, but it just rolls off the tongue as something Tom's elephant would say, or perhaps my elephant.
My elephant likes to just prod at other people's elephants.
Yeah, it kind of does. Not scared of heights, but scared of sudden stop at the bottom, Joyce Trivet.
Yeah.
That's a practical elephant.
Word.
Jenny Schaefer, I hate when patient families ask how long the patient has to live. My general answer is nobody knows. We don't have an expiration date stamped on our bodies somewhere. Speak for yourself, Jenny. Mine's on my taint. Each person is different. Well, this is true, and actually prognosticating when someone's going to die is very hard.
Can I speak as a patient, though? It's a question that you have to ask because you need to plan. There's so much that goes into a death.
And you're
the best arbiter of that if you're the medical professional that we're talking to.
No, I mean, I tell patients.
So we're not asking for a timeline, are we, when we ask that? I mean, maybe some people are, but I'm asking for your wisdom and experience of give me a rough scale of what you think this could progress to.
Right, and that's what we try to do, but I always tell patients we're really bad prognosticators. Here's my experience with this. This is what I think. I think you should get these affairs in order because this is typically how it plays out, but anything could happen, and I'm not taking away hope, and I'm just telling you that if it were my mother, I would plan on this long on the outside of things. And it could be shorter than that because we just don't know. Especially at the very end of life, we're really bad at it. We're really bad at saying, you know, it's going to be a day or it's going to be an hour. You know, I've seen agonal breathing patterns go on for 3 days and patient not die and family there are vigil candles and everything. And it's very tough. It's hard on family too because they get exhausted. We get exhausted as caregivers. It's very hard. We wish we could be better at it, but we're not. The other thing that came up was, we talked about earlier, was these quality adjusted life years. So it's a way of rationing what's the benefit. So if you save a 3-year-old child with a drug that cures their sickle cell or their cystic fibrosis, you save this many quality adjusted life years of good quality life that they could have had. And that's worth X. Healthcare economists can say it's worth this many millions of dollars. Whereas a 74-year-old person who dies, who you cure of something, and they live another 2 years of kind of debilitated life with home care, et cetera, that's worth X. So there are ways to even sort of compute and calculate these things. Does that mean it's ethically right? Does that mean there's a moral basis to it? Does that mean we need to act on this as a society? These are the outstanding questions.
We have to make these judgments as a society. And I think this is where the far left goes askew.
Tell me about the far left, Tom Heineberg.
They think anything that is harm to any person is automatically bad.
So all life is equal and valuable.
Yes.
Yeah. That is a tenet of the far left.
And that's not true.
Well, so a tenet of...
And I just mean it the way in which it's not true that a 74-year-old life and a 3-year-old life are very different. And taking one is very different than taking another. Now, it's both bad, but one is worse.
Well, I think you can make an argument for that statement. You could also make an argument that both are equal. And this is tough because these are the soft realms of human sort of discourse that you can argue both ways. I actually think, you know, the idea that there's certain... So in other words, if you're going to price a drug based on the value you create, you have to look at those things. Because... saving a 70-year-old person from Alzheimer's is a different value than saving a 2-year-old from a potentially fatal genetic disease. So you do need to make those calculations if you're going to price a drug based on value, which honestly is very hard to do because how are the insurance companies, I mean, are they going to really respect that value-based pricing? How do we act? I mean, the way it's priced now is pharma just charges everything they possibly can that the market will bear. And sometimes what it won't bear.
Yeah. Question time. Who's the worst generation ever? Answer, it's the baby boomers. But one good thing about the baby boomers, Z, is that they're entitled narcissists. Why is that a good thing, Z? I'll tell you why, Z. It's a good thing because hopefully they might change the face of hospice care because they're gonna want the best quality care for themselves.
You know, I was wondering where all that ish was going, Tom Heineberg, and you actually pulled it out of a firestorm of hate just at the very end. By the way, Colleen Garvey, I like your comment. My elephant has gone rogue. So, but this is actually true. And actually, there have been books written about the narcissism of the boomers. They were one of the first generations to really exhibit tremendous narcissism. Coming of age in the 60s, the me generation.
I'd also say that it's not the boomers' fault because they lived during the most, the boom times in American economics. So what would we all do if, like, you know, we were 16 and stepdad bought us a BMW? We'd be like, sweet dude, you wouldn't wash that BMW, you wouldn't take care of it. You know what I mean? You just treat it like crap. And that's what they did with the American economy. Again, you suck, boomers. I'm kidding, I love you. I'm sorry. I've gone off the rails here, Z.
Stop, Tommy, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. No, but honestly, if the boomers are able to revolutionize elder care, hospice, end-of-life care, home care, they will have done a great service to the world. My parents are boomers. I love them dearly. But they are not my parents, but boomers tend to have... There's a whole book called Boomeritis by Ken Wilber, who is a boomer, about how this sort of self-involvement happened. Now, look at Gen Xers. We're just as self-involved as the boomers. We're just broke. We just don't have the same resources to actualize our self-involvement. And millennials are even broker. And they don't even care because they're like, I'm taking a mental health day, period, I'm out.
We're so broke, we're just like, YOLO, bro.
YOLO!
Just gonna eat ramen from the garbage. I think that actually would be a great thing and probably the most lasting contribution to society if they can change death in America, because death in America is not like death in third world countries.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So you're saying they could be Death Eaters.
That's dope. That's a dope title to
it's
go
pretty
out
dope.
On. Yeah.
Boomers as Death Eaters. Yeah. I'm writing that paper right now, people. NEJM, stay tuned. It's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. Let's read some comments. My grandma was over at St. Agnes Hospital for a week now. Oh my gosh, St. Agnes in Clovis in Fresno? That I know that hospital well. My dad used to work there, Z-Dad. Sung Lee. For a week now, and they diagnosed her with pneumonia because of pulmonary fibrosis, and she got out today. She's 88, and right now she can't walk, so I take care of her instead of using a health caretaker. So Sung, first of all, thank you for your service to your grandmother, but this is a great example. So pulmonary fibrosis is often a terminal condition. She's 88, so she's already in a lot of difficulty, and pneumonia is often one of the complications that we dread the most because it's very hard to treat an elderly patient. So I'm glad your grandmother got better, but do be aware that this is, and you know this already, that this is a struggle. And taking care of her at home is also a big struggle. If you've done it before, you know how hard it can be. I know my mother, my wife's, did you see that Freudian slip? My mother, I call my wife my mother.
That was creepy.
That is not okay on any level.
Hello, mommy.
Hello, mother. It puts the lotion on its skin.
What would your mom have to say about that?
Oh, she's a psychiatrist. She'd be like, of course you married your mother, and your mother is awesome.
Of course, your mommy is the best.
Your mommy is the best, and your daddy is an idiot. I'm telling you, he's a practically developmentally delayed. He doesn't even know how to tie his laces. And they tell me, the doctor tells me he doesn't have dementia, but I'm telling you, because I know him, that he is totally gormed out. I mean, totally gormed out. This is my mom. That's why this is how I inherited all this.
Vanessa has a great comment. She says, make death more acceptable and stop letting everyone believe we can keep people alive forever. Which, maybe this is the reverse argument of what I was saying about the boomers about how they're gonna change death. Maybe they're gonna double down on their narcissism and think they can live forever and use their money to do it.
I'm just saying, you know? I'm just saying.
But if they pull it off, go for it.
Then booyah. Booyah. Leah Stewart, Logan's wife, sure, weighs in with the word truth, which is truthy enough for me. Better pay a little respect to that baby boomer running life support on your baby, your dad, or your mate, or you, Victoria. I feel you, Victoria. I feel you. I like the way you split your name into two parts, though, because that's the bomb. I'm going to be Z-Dog.
Cynthia says, millennials can be great, but mine can be like Tom when they want. Listen, we got angst, people. We got angst. Okay? Tom grew up during a depression. Y'all called it a recession, but it was a depression.
These guys think it's a depression. They haven't seen depression, man. I'm telling you, I lived through the 20s, the 30s depression. Okay, I was in that dust bowl, all right? Because I'm reincarnated because I'm a Buddhist, you know what I'm saying? I'm none of those things. However, I do meditate. Tom, we were talking about meditation, by the way. You've reached some breakthrough now where you're meditating twice a day?
I'm meditating now, and I've found that I can interrupt my thoughts, but that's as far as I can go. And Z was telling me he gets to these like transcendental states where he's like one with all consciousness and just like hell 3.0.
I'm also high AF, people, but that's enough. No, I'm kidding. By the way, Victoria followed up with, I am the bomb. Thank you, Victoria. That was pretty awesome. Yeah, no, meditation is an interesting thing. We've talked about it before. I'm not going to bore you guys with it now, but I'm going to say this. The more you observe the mind, the more you understand how it works, the more you can affect how you behave. Instead of just reacting to your elephant, you can actually act with conscious intent, which is, I think, the goal of living a good life. In my mind, do you want to be an automaton, a slave to your elephant, Tom Heineberg? Maybe you do.
Well, can I talk about, all right, I'll talk about my real reason for meditating. I think part of my real reason for meditating is because I'm scared of death. And I'd like to be able to, and pain and suffering. So I'd like to be able to accept pain and suffering, not identify with it, and use meditation as a tool to guard against it.
So are you afraid of death, this pain and suffering that comes with death, or death itself as a cessation?
No, the pain and suffering that comes with death.
Ah, so you want to prepare yourself to have equanimity when faced with pain and suffering of death.
I would like to be able to control it, because like we've talked about on the show, opiates don't work long term. So meditation seems like the only avenue that will work long term.
End of life opioids can be tremendously helpful. And
yeah, no, totally.
But so here's the thing, Tom. I've heard it said, and I think I agree with this, that advanced meditation is actually a kind of practicing for death. So people have said that what it is you're able to transcend the idea that you're an ego, that you're sensation, that you identify with this mind. And when you transcend it and you're just the awareness in which it all arises, death isn't even a thing anymore. It's like, okay. And that practice for dying, very advanced meditators will actually meditate in a corpse position, laying flat with their palms upward. The advanced Zen meditators and those guys. And it's this idea that you are literally preparing for death in that way. And there's a religious cosmology around it too, because the Tibetan Book of the Dead and all that, yeah. There's a process for how you're supposed to die and all that. And that I don't get into because I'm not religious, but I do like the science of the mind that allows you to see death as a part of life and not get caught in it.
I think I have back pain because I have a slipped disc, right? And so it'd be really nice to just not get caught up in my anger when I'm irritated from my pain and be able to interrupt those thoughts and, you know, like I said, like I've said before, like not say the thing that's gonna ruin the next 48 hours of my marriage, or, you know, not be mean to the person on the subway for no reason, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it can work, and I've been in situations where I'm vomiting in a bucket from eating bad oysters, and I'm able to detach and through the meditative practice, and it's a very different experience. The suffering component goes away. You still feel all that horrible stuff, but it's not horrible anymore. It's just like, oh, this is happening, and I accept it in the present moment. By the way, Lena Alb, related to that, says, maybe meditation will bring you compassion for baby boomers and all other living things. Right? Right? Actually, Tom, you never said you don't have compassion for baby boomers.
No, I never said that.
No. He said that baby boomers are narcissistic, which is an observation that he had. And I went through all the generations with my little silly observations, but what I'll say is that you can still have tremendous compassion for everybody and still say, well, this is an observation that I find. There's narcissism in the baby boomer population. Okay, I still love them tremendously. And, you know, I love my parents. I love other people's parents. I love all my boomer mentors. They made us who we are. Just like we made you, Tom Heineber.
Listen, intergenerational warfare is fun.
Okay? Oh, it's more than fun.
It's a fun pastime.
It's good sport. It's like
nobody
badminton.
Means it. There are terrible people in every generation. Every generation has, you know, I mean, Ted Bundy was a boomer, right? But then so was, you know, Martin Luther
Listen,
King.
Listen, two right? words, right? Lawrence Welk. Most hated criminal on the face of the earth or the most amazing bubble producing musician conductor ever. It all is perspective. And I think on that note, Tom Heineber,
should we be out soon?
I think we're ready to be out. What do you think? We've gone 40 minutes.
Hit us with the outro.
Make it happen.
Good enough. I already went out.
Oh, you killed it?
Yeah, good enough. I was like, good enough.